Why is Silicon Valley so innovative? Can you like put a finger on the essence?
Okay, you could ask why Silicon Valley exists in the first place.
Okay.
Hewlett-Packard is the obvious story. Hewlett-Packard came from Fred Terman. Okay, Fred Terman was the head of electrical engineering at Stanford, and he was a mentor to Hewlett and Packard, and many other, and the Varian brothers. Varian was a very early Silicon Valley startup. There's a book called The Secret History of Silicon Valley. It came out last year. I've been here for 30 years. I never knew this stuff. Okay, so in World War II, the most important thing in the entire war effort, which was like the most important thing in the world, was radar. Okay, because the Germans had really good bombers, and Germans also had really good, they had the best radar anti-aircraft scenario. And so the Allies couldn't effectively bomb Germany because the Germans would shoot them down because they had really good radar. And so it was like this huge crash program to develop radar, and it was based at MIT in Cambridge. And so it was the MIT radar laboratories. It turns out Fred Terman had been there during the war. And at the end of, but he had some connection to California. But for whatever reason, Terman came west to Stanford at the end of World War II and brought a whole bunch of the radar guys. And at the time, radar, it wasn't digital. It was all analog, and it was radio. It was microwave. And in fact, the Varian brothers, which was the birth of Silicon Valley, that was the klystron tube, which was essential for radar. And so this book, The Secret History of Silicon Valley, is all about how the roots of the magic of Silicon Valley came from the war and the need to develop radar. Fascinating, isn't that not? Because we, you know, I would have thought, oh, it's Intel and the integrated circuit. So I was just reading last night, this is now the 40th anniversary of the 4004, the first ever processor born right here at Intel 40 years ago. And so that's a nice time to reflect. And I'm sure Computer History Museum will be having stories about this. Then you can trace it to Shockley. So Shockley invented the transistor at Bell Labs on the East Coast. And why did he come west? I don't remember the reason, but that's what happened. And Shockley spawned Fairchild, okay? The traitorous eight engineers who left Shockley because he was such an asshole, okay? Fairchild really was developing the first integrated circuits. And then Intel was a spinoff of Fairchild. And actually, in a sense, Apple is a spin-off of Intel, in the sense that you had Woz Jobs, Mike Markula was the business plan and the funding for Apple, and he was an Intel engineer. That's where he made his money, from Intel. Okay, so you can trace it all back to Shockley, in that sense, on the digital side of the story. So anyway, now it's 40 years later, because there's so much money here and so much venture capital and so many people are so richly rewarded, people who want to be entrepreneurs tend to come here more than any other place. That's a large part of it. That's the biggest part of it, I think. It's, you know, I mean, it's a cumulative melting pot kind of a thing. So, And there's long lead times. I read something recently about how, you know, London was the center of world commerce for a very long time through the 1800s. And London continued to be the center of world commerce long after activity had really moved to New York. Okay? It just, there's a long lag time. And so where's the center of world commerce now? Well, I don't even know. It's between London, New York, and Singapore, right? I mean, now it's global. So, and in the same way, entrepreneurial activity I think Bangalore is a huge center of entrepreneurial activity, and so is the Boston area, and but probably Silicon Valley is still the number one, you would say. I mean, there's a combination of many, many things. There's the venture capital funding, which is what everyone's looking for. But then there's also the availability of expertise and materials and, you know, the parts and pieces that you need.
And then you have this history associated with this place. For example, you were talking about sitting at Pete's Coffee in coffee shop and in Palo Alto, and then like people walking by.
Yes, and that's very inspiring. So in the same way that the cafes of Paris were a spawning ground for the whole literature movement of the late 1800s and the early 1900s, you know, now Silicon Valley's a little bit like that for high tech. My background is in hardware. I always thought I would have a very long, busy career building prototypes. And it hasn't been the case. Why? Because the world of technology has just blown past hardware. It's relentlessly moving forward. And actually, I would say, you know, if you take the big picture, there is a huge wave happening right now based on the Arduino platform, which is open source, which is a very powerful thing. So if you combine Arduino and then the big brother is kind of Linux. And I just saw an article last week of the guy who has put Linux on a flash stick that's this big for $25. Okay, $25 for a Linux-based platform that's the size of a memory stick. That is very exciting for all kinds of things.
Cool.
I mean, actually, then okay, so here's one thing that Silicon Valley has for it is because it's such a nexus, there is a meetup going on every single day of the week here in the Bay Area, depending on whether it's biotech or whether it's new tech or whether it's, you know, just there's so many different avenues of entrepreneurial activity, social networking stuff. The meetups are a very important component because it brings people together. And that you can trace that back to the Homebrew Computer Club, right? There's the Hacker Dojo, which again is kind of modeled after the Homebrew Computer Club. The Hacker Dojo is very exciting, and that's now sprouting up in other cities. There are other Hacker Dojos starting. And then there's the whole thing called Noise Bridge, and there's a thing called Hacker Space, which is a generic kind of a movement. That's all very exciting. And you could probably say that it started here. But certainly the first Hacker Dojo was here, and Dave Weekly, he's a good guy to interview. I just met Dave recently. And where did I meet Dave? At a Innovation Institute meetup, which is like another meetup, except they're charging money. But
well, there's a greater variety of cross-fertilization happening.
Yes, that's right. I think there is a very healthy culture of innovation here that just really took off in the last couple of years. And in fact, so I went to a meetup a couple days ago of the Silicon Valley Innovation Institute, SVII. Howard Lieberman is the founder. He's a friend of mine. Howard's an old-time guy, and his idea is he's actually charging $30 for people to come, so he's making money on this. But he doesn't seem to have any problem getting people to come. Anyway, there's so many gatherings like that. You know, you've got the whole quantized self movement now, which is all about biomonitoring.
Yeah.
It's biomonitoring tying in with health, and that is a huge growth area. Huge.
Could you, like, use Steve Jobs as an example? I feel like he was more of a design connoisseur.
Yes.
And he cross-fertilized from other fields of design into computing.
As between Woz and Jobs, Woz was the innovator. Steve Jobs was the marketing person. Woz was the inventor. Okay? But even to look back at the Apple II, that was a lot about product design. That was kind of the seeds of Steve Jobs developing his talents, because the plastic case, the lightweight plastic case, even though it was never intended as anything portable, because Jobs and Woz, the Apple I and the Apple II came out, the Apple I came right out of the Homebrew Computer Club. Woz wanted something he could bring to the computer club and show off to his friends. And to think portability was not even in the factor, except that they were comparing it with big machines that were not going to be portable. And the previous generation depended on a big heavy teletype to interface to the computer, and there was no way any of that was portable. So that was what was fueling the excitement back in the 70s. So then it comes to the Apple II, and it was definitely Steve Jobs's idea to, you know, the Altairs, the M-Size, the Chromemcos, all of that generation, they were all heavy metal boxes. And it was brilliant of Steve to find Rod Holt to make a switching power supply, which was a lightweight power supply. There's no big heavy transformers. And to put the plastic case on it so that you actually could carry it under your arm and you could carry it somewhere. We never really advertised that, but it was part of the appeal. And Steve never forgot that, right? And so, you know, you can trace that into the Macintosh, which was had a handle built right into it. That was pretty obvious. And then, you know, then Steve left Apple, and Apple lost its way into a profusion of beige boxes. If you remember the history, the next big thing on the landscape was the Mac 2 CX. That was a highly modular, highly manufacturable computer, and that was a landmark. But there was nothing, it wasn't about portability, and it wasn't about industrial design, it was about manufacturability. And actually, at the same time, Dell was first, it was Compaq, was a big success, making the PC highly manufacturable and highly modular. And so the Mac 2CX was kind of Apple's answer to that. But then the next wave was when Steve came back to Apple, and now it was the iMac, I guess they called it, which was the bubble-shaped plastic. And that was now Jonathan Ive, okay? And how fortunate for Steve that he had Jonathan Ive. Jonathan Ive was already on the staff at Apple when Steve came to Apple. So Steve just saw a good thing and latched onto it. You know, Steve's a self-taught guy. But Woz didn't have that kind of vision. Woz is more about making do with parts. It's all about functionality. And Steve Jobs brought the design aspect to it. The first audio recorders were wire recorders, the Nagra wire recorders. And those were portable. And Alan Lomax had one of the, well, I don't know what he used, but, you know, Alan Lomax is the guy who made his whole career by having a portable, good quality recording thing in a little suitcase. And he carried it into the Mississippi Delta and recorded all these old guys, right? You know who you would trace it back to is Hartmut Esslinger. Hartmut Esslinger was a founder of Frog Design, which was a very popular, in fact, IDEO had connection with Frog Design. I'm not sure exactly how, but Frog Design was very successful in the early 80s. And when we were designing the mice at Apple in 1982, the mouse for the Lisa was a Frog Design. Frog Design was mocking up Macintosh cases for us in 1982. That was Hartmut. So Steve, you know, Steve paid it a lot of attention and took a lot of inspiration from Hartmut Esslinger and Frog Design.
And did your trip with him to India make any design changes in his design?
That's a good question. We didn't encounter any technology at all. I regret that I never even had a camera with me, but it's because we were kind of focused on a spiritual journey and nothing, you know, getting away from materialism, and didn't want to carry a camera because that was kind of materialistic, right? Nowadays, I would say capturing a story is more about the essence. And so whatever it takes to capture stories, video, audio.
So maybe could you tell us a bit about the whole, that trip?
That trip came about because Steve and I both got copies of Be Here Now at the same time. And Be Here Now was a breakthrough book of kind of like the psychedelic culture of America goes to India looking for holy men. That's what Be Here Now represented. And they rushed it into print. It came out quite early in 1972. It was a brand new story. And I had never seen anything like that. It just completely blew me away. I mean, I personally was always a voracious reader. I had never even been exposed to Eastern literature at all. I knew nothing about Buddhism, philosophy, that kind of thing. Be Here Now was very...
Ram Dass, right? That's Ram
Yes,
Dass?
Richard Alpert. Yeah. He was associated with Tim Leary. So they were the psychedelic... In fact, the book, the big book that came out recently was the Harvard Psychedelic Club. And so that was Andrew Weil and Tim Leary and Richard Alpert and...
So you both read that book?
Yes. We both got it in the bookstore at Reed College. And that was such an amazing thing. There was lots to talk about. And so I can remember asking people, well, this is very interesting. What else should I read next? I really had no idea. And the next book that showed up was Autobiography of a Yogi, which is a very compelling book. I had never seen anything like it, even though it was from the 50s. It was Paramahansa Yogananda, and very readable book. And then the next one was Ramakrishna and His Disciples. Okay, and now we're like in India. This is the Indian current, right? And then it was Aurobindo and Sai Baba and Ramana Maharshi, right? And so that was the genesis of my trip to India with Steve. We were, you know, we had read all these books. And so Robert Friedland was the head of the student body at Reed. And he actually was part of the Be Here Now scene. I don't even know how he got hooked up with them, but he was. So he had gone to India the previous year in 71, just before the book came out. And there was a big scene of American hippies in India all around Neem Karoli Baba. And it was Robert who told us we should go. And it was the Kumbh Mela. So, you know, if Robert alone telling us, that wouldn't have been quite enough. The fact that Robert gave us personal references of where to stay in New Delhi, that helped a lot. And then the fact that there was a Kumbh Mela, we were going. And yet still, I didn't have any money. So it was really Steve, who had now dropped out of Reed, and he was earning money at Atari. And he had money for a ticket. And so it was Steve's idea to me. He says, we should go to India. Robert can fix us up, you know, and it's the Kumbh Mela. And I said, oh, that sounds great. I don't have any money. And Steve said, well, I'll lend you the money for the ticket. And I said, all right. And that was the trip. So it was thanks to Nolan Bushnell, who started Atari, who gave Steve his job.
So did that trip change you both in a major way, or was it a disappointment, or just a widening experience?
It was a widening experience. It was because we were 20 years old, and traveling the world is an important thing to do. So it was just in the category of general good travel experiences. We didn't really, in terms of actual real life experiences, there was nothing so earth-shaking. You know, we went to ashrams. The Neem Karoli ashram was deserted. It was completely deserted. So that was a little bit of a disappointment. We went and found Harikant Baba, who was like Paul Bunyan. He's like this mythical reincarnating avatar. You've probably heard of Harikant Baba. And it was a young guy. And he was a little bit gay. He was like wearing his pastel colored saris and changing his clothes 4 times a day. And it was funny. It was slightly disappointing in the sense that we didn't have a Neem Karoli Baba experience. The story in Be Here Now was all about Bhagavan Das, who was this guy from California. You know this whole story?
No.
Anyway, well, Bhagavan Das was like a stoner hippie from California who went to India and was smoking lots of ganja, and he had long dreadlocks, but he had hooked up with Neem Karoli somehow. And there was a scene around Neem Karoli because he was such a popular holy man, and Neem Karoli was a very remarkable human being, obviously. And it was when Richard Alpert was traveling around India trying to figure out what it was that LSD did, because they didn't know. They just didn't know. They didn't have any neurochemistry models for what LSD did, except that it mimicked psychosis, right? But it was people had religious experiences, of course. Richard Alpert had miracle experiences with Neem Karoli Baba. And then when you got into Autobiography of a Yogi, it's all about miracle experiences. Mm-hmm. And then when you got into Sai Baba and...
Oh, it's very exciting when you're in your 20s.
Yes, it's very exciting because you're young and you don't know what the world holds in store. And I personally was a scientist, very skeptical of psychic phenomenon, very dubious, but I had an open mind.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if there's something going on here, this is very interesting, let's go look at it. So I was disappointed in the sense that I didn't find anything tangible with regard to psychic abilities. You read those Sai Baba books and they're just gushing with all kinds of wild stuff. You would compare it to crop circles and UFOs, right?
Yeah.
And now, of course, I mean, it was just 2 months ago, Sai Baba's now passed, and now the biographies are coming out about what a fraud he was.
And how much gold he had under his
pillow. Yeah. So, actually, that whole era is just now coming to an end. Because Sai Baba was the last of that generation, right?
Yeah.
You had Maharishi, Rajneesh, Yogi Bhajan.
Yeah, they all rode the wave.
Gumaraji, yeah. Right? Sai Baba was the last.
Yeah.
My girlfriend at Reed, Elizabeth, who was also very good friends with Steve, and I suspected that she and Steve had a little affair going at one point, because she grew up here in California. Anyway, she joined the Daffrey John Communion, who was Bubba Jones, Daffrey John. He just died a couple of years ago. And the books are coming out about him now. He had a big sex scandal in his life. And he's the one who bought the island in Fiji. And he went to Fiji and he knew they would never extradite him. So he just never came back, right? Anyway, Elizabeth was an insider. And she was very jaded about that whole thing. So,
yeah.
So in a sense, this is kind of like the end of childhood about the miracle stories about holy men. And right. yet, so here's a good theme. Now, technology, between the iPhone and the internet and Wi-Fi and Google, all the knowledge of the world is here in your hand, anywhere you are. That's a miracle. It's a complete miracle. The miracle is now happening, and it's technology. If you had somehow missed the last 20 years, right?
Yeah.
If you were an Aborigine somewhere, what someone can do with their iPhone is magic.
It doesn't even have to be an iPhone. It could just be a simple Nokia. Nokia
could be an open source Android.
Yeah.
It's magic. Going back to the 60s, LSD definitely had an influence on my worldview, and Steve Jobs has been quite outspoken about the value of LSD on the evolution of his thinking. And, interestingly, Woz definitely never took psychedelics. He may have never even smoked pot. But he's a very unusual case. He's a mutant, in a sense. I think the effect of psychedelics on the general culture is well acknowledged. There's a whole shelf full of books, and what the Dormouse said, John Markoff's book, that's all about psychedelics and technology. So, but that's like in the field, that's kind of like on the field of biochemistry, in a sense. And MDMA was just the later wave of that. And MDMA was so powerful because it's not an intoxicant. It leaves you lucid, but it leaves you, the same reasons why it is so valuable for PTSD is because it's a powerful therapeutic tool, because it's not an intoxicant. It's a little bit of an upper. It's related to methamphetamine, but it also has some amazing ability to promote empathy, right? Including empathy for yourself, which is what PTSD needs. PTSD is about dealing with traumatic experience. So anyway, I don't really, I was always more, personally, I was always identified as a technologist. And I was always very focused on my technical career. So I just started going to psychedelics conferences recently, in the last couple of years. Why? Because I'm kind of giving up on my technical career. We have a limited time in our lives. I used to always be focused on technical conferences and trying to get my next job. But now I go to psychedelics conferences, and I find it very invigorating. The people who are interested in psychedelics are the people who are interested in consciousness, which is the most interesting topic of all. It's the biggest overarching topic, okay? Because really, when you talk about technology, technology is about communication as much more than anything. It's about getting things done, but if you look at the meaning of from the telegraph to the radio to the telephone to the television, that's all communication. It's all communication. So technology in the service of human communication, that's an immense thread of life on Earth. And it's more true now than ever. If you look at what's happening right now in social networking with Google Plus and the Google Wave, the Wave didn't really take off, but social networking in general, it's all about communication, and it's very exciting.
And you find the people you want to hang out with.
Yes.
And that's a big deal.
Yes. It's a huge deal. I just did a show last month with James Fadiman. His book is called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. And one of the topics that comes up is that psychedelics is just now having a renaissance, in the sense that the very first LSD studies, government-sanctioned studies, are just happening now, like in the last couple of years. And because neuroscience has taken so many leaps forward, because now we can give psychedelics to people, and map their brain second by second, and you can see exactly what's going on with functional MRI. That is so exciting. So it's now the promise of psychedelics from 40 years ago is now still just now coming to fruition, in the sense that we can now investigate what's actually happening. That's tremendously exciting. So it's almost not even about the psychedelics anymore. It's about the confluence of technology and neuroscience in conjunction with the kind of work that Shulgin does. You know, I mean, Shulgin's probably not going to live out the year, but he's just published the Shulgin Index, which is a landmark event. That's, you know what that is? The Shulgin, he just published it this summer. It's the first ever large-scale compendium of all psychoactive substances. And he's the man to do it. And Shulgin personally, the number that I heard was in the 240s. Like 240 to 250 new substances that Shulgin synthesized and took himself and wrote about what it did in his notebook. Okay? That is highly valuable in terms of neuroscience, because of what it, you know, I mean, as time goes on, we realize how special LSD is, because there's hundreds and hundreds of all these other compounds that have some psychoactive activity, but they're not. LSD is the atomic weapons of psychoactivity. So, anyway, it's not even so much about the drugs anymore. It's about the whole story about human life.
And it's ironic that the VA is like now an early adopter of psilocybin.
Yes,
psilocybin,
that's right.
For treating PTSD, right?
Yes.
And you saw there was, you said something about Ken Casey and the...
It was the VA, which is part of the military, that was giving psychedelics to the volunteers in whatever year it was, gave it to Ken Kesey, and that had a huge ripple effect in the culture.
So now they're early adopters for psilocybin.
Yes. And the other big, huge part of the story is... What we know now is, to take a different tack here, the war on cancer has been a huge failure. The war on drugs has been a huge failure. But the war on cancer has also been a huge failure. Even though there's been immense steps forward in medical technology, cancer is at an epidemic right now. Brain cancer is just amazingly high incidence. And many types of cancer, nobody even knows. It's a huge challenge. But what we do know is that the psychedelics are proving very valuable in end-of-life treatment for terminal cancer. Psilocybin's especially good for that. And Aldous Huxley started that, right? Taking mescaline when he was dying. But anyway, that's a big quality of life issue. There's a book called The Biology of Belief by Bruce Lipton, and there is now a whole body of research about how, to kind of really simplify it, in case you're not familiar with this, Bruce Lipton is a neurobiologist and he's a metabolic scientist. He was at Stanford, he's moved on now, but he makes a very, very good case that everybody has cancer all the time. Everybody. We have very complex bodies, and there are mutations happening all the time. We all have cancer. Your immune system does an amazingly good job dealing with it as a normal course of events. So the immune system is constantly repairing the damage. By the time that your cancer shows up as a tumor, it means your immune system has not been keeping up with the job. Well, guess what? What we also know is that your immune system is very responsive to your subconscious. And when you are stressed, you're shutting down your immune system, because it's the fight or flight syndrome. You're stressed and it's now, we can't heal because we have to be fleeing. right?
Yeah.
That's what Bruce Lipton is talking about, but there are many others. And so psychedelics play an important part of that story because within the picture of learning to relax and promote healthy function of your immune system, psychedelics have an important role to play. Human civilization has, you know, I mean, you have flowerings of civilization where it gets wealthy and then it peaks and then it dies off, and it happened to China, and it happened to Rome and Greece, and it happened to England, and now it's happening to us. You know, the United States has now peaked and we're now on the downward slide. Innovation is something that you don't, well, I don't know, they say necessity is the mother of invention. But I do think that the culture of innovation that we have now is a rare and miraculous thing, and it's because our society is so rich in so many ways, and that's a good thing. And actually, there's a lot of necessity right now, so that's good also. The show that I did last month was about the transition movement. So there's a book called The Transition Handbook, mm-hmm. came out of England. Do you know
Rob
that?
Hopkins.
Yes, Rob Hopkins. Yeah. And he's saying, between peak oil and climate change, we're in deep shit, okay? We're facing mass die-offs of human beings over the next decade, okay? It's grim. Not here. It's grim in the rest of the world. And the number one thing he's talking about is resilience, which is innovation.